The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Talks on the revival of the JCPOA in Vienna are getting more complicated every hour, with the US not making a political decision. Ukraine accuses Russia of bombing a children's hospital in Mariupol. Moscow says Russian forces do not fire on civilian targets. Also ahead, a United Nations war crimes panel calls for a US probe into the civilian casualties of its airstrikes in Syria. Thank you for joining us. Iran's top security official says the U.S. approach towards the ongoing talks in the Vienna shows that Washington has no desire for a good deal. Ali Shamkhani, the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, says the way Washington is approaching Iran's proposals, the unacceptable proposals it tables, and its insistence on reaching a quick agreement with empty justifications are all indicative of a lack of will for a strong deal that would be acceptable to both sides. He warns the Vienna talks become more complicated every hour as the U.S. refrains from making a political decision. The parties involved in the Vienna talks say progress has been made towards the restoration of the 2015 pact, but Iran says Washington needs to make a political decision to ensure Tehran's basic demands are met. Those demands include guarantees that the United States will not quit the agreement again and that all sanctions are removed in a verifiable manner. While sources close to the Iranian negotiating team in Vienna insist that the revival of the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA, is contingent on political decisions by the U.S. This comes as Iran's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani, held talks with the European Union's coordinator, Enrique Mora, in the Austrian capital. We spoke to our correspondent in Vienna, Homer Lesky, for more details on this.
Sources close to the Iranian team continue to insist that this would only be possible if the Americans make the necessary political decisions, and that when I ask them whether there are still some outstanding issues remaining or whether those have been resolved, they are telling me that those issues are still being discussed. We still have some outstanding issues. Previously, we've been told they include the scope of sanctions, they include some reports are saying the issues of sequencing or how the implementation will take place, because, of course, once the decision is made here in Vienna for the JCPOA to be restored, you might see the foreign ministers come here to make the announcement, and then there will be a preparation period before the re-implementation day. And, of course, this involves a lot of sequencing and measures both by the Americans and the Iranians, and lengthy discussions have been taking place on what those measures need to be. And also, let's just take a look at the official positions that have been expressed by the Iranians, the Supreme National Security Council, saying that Iran believes the prospect for a deal is unclear because of the Washington's delay to come up with a political decision, and saying that rapid access to a deal requires new initiatives. What we've been hearing also as creative solutions that are needed for the demands that are now that now exist between the negotiating partners for these issues to be resolved, they still need to work on what they call creative solutions.
While Iran has launched futures contracts at its energy exchange market, as Iran has the world's largest oil and gas reserves, the launch of futures can turn the country into a pricing reference for its crude oil and natural gas in the region. Saman Khajuri reports.
Iran has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the naphtha and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas, and petrochemical companies, join Iran's energy exchange on futures platform, Iran's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. While there are also some strong hedging tools, they provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Iran's energy exchange will contribute to transparency and the predictability of Iran's economy. Saman Khajuri, Tehran.
Right, let's turn to the latest developments regarding the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine that has entered its third week now. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky is accusing Russia of genocide and a war crime, saying Russian aircraft have bombed a children's hospital in the besieged city of Mariupol. A number of injuries have been reported, including women in labor. The UN human rights body has also expressed deep concern about the usage of weapons in populated areas, especially health facilities. When asked about the incident, the Kremlin, however, has said that Russian forces do not open fire on civilian targets. Moscow instead says Ukraine is using hospitals to set up firing positions after moving out staff and patients. According to Mariupol's mayor, more than 1,200 civilians have died since the start of the offensive against the city, and many are left without basic needs, including power and water. The US and the UK, meanwhile, once again turned down Ukraine's request for a no-fly zone over its airspace as the Russia-Ukraine conflict is entering its third week. The rejection was announced during a joint presser by the British Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, and her American counterpart, Antony Blinken. Truss noted that such a move would lead to a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. She, however, assured Kiev that London will continue to reinforce it with more anti-aircraft weapons. Russian President Vladimir Putin has already warned the West against declaring Ukraine a no-fly zone. He said any country making such a declaration would be considered a participant in an armed confrontation with Moscow. This is while the Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have so far destroyed over 970 Ukrainian tanks and armored vehicles. They have also downed nearly 100 drones. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has arrived in Turkey for planned talks with his Ukrainian counterparts. Now, the United States and the European Union target Russia with sweeping new sanctions in response to Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. Now, Washington is reportedly weighing sanctions on Russian nuclear power supplier Rosatom. A senior U.S. administration official says a final decision has not been made yet. The European Union has placed 146 Russian lawmakers, 14 Kremlin-linked oligarchs and their families on its sanctions list. Brussels is also planning to broaden the measures to include cryptocurrencies. The new sanctions come a day after Washington banned the Russian energy imports. In response, Moscow said it was working on a broad response to Western sanctions. Russia says the measures will be swift and that the pain will be felt in the West's most sensitive areas. Meanwhile, the Russian military action is coming down hard on Ukraine's economy. Ukraine's central bank says the Russian offensive has caused a slowdown in economic activity, which has seen 5% of deposits drain out of the bank accounts of companies in 2 weeks. The UK has announced plans to phase out imports of Russian oil and oil products by the end of the year, while the EU says it will reduce its dependence by two-thirds. The announcement has seen oil prices soar, that is even higher, with some analysts saying it could push Europe into a recession. Saeed Boreza has more from London.
Already struggling with the cost of living crisis, ordinary Europeans are now feeling the pinch at the pump, with the conflict in Ukraine pushing up the already high food and fuel prices. As plans to phase out oil imports from Russia are drawn up, the ripple effects of the Ukraine crisis are being felt across the continent.
Here in London, people are feeling the economic cost of the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine at the gas pump. Prices have been rising steadily since the start of the year and have now hit a record high. And what that means is that it's going to have a knock-on effect on the cost of transporting goods and, by extension, on the already rising cost of living.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil. The EU imports 27% of its oil from Russia, the UK 11%, and the US just 8%, which is why Europe will feel the effect of the bans far more acutely than the US. The EU also plans to slash its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. That's 26% of their supply.
It's hard, bloody hard, but it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But to make it possible, experts say the Europeans will have to make difficult compromises.
For the new government and Germany actually now saying, actually, we're going to bring back nuclear. Well, that was one of the key things, that they were going to get rid of nuclear completely, very quickly indeed. Then also coal, getting rid of the coal-burning power stations, and particularly those from maybe the using Polish coal, brown coal, which is incredibly dirty.
But could all this have been prevented? While the U.S. and Europe blame Russia's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine for the soaring energy costs, some experts say it's a crisis that could have been averted.
One of the great things about international affairs is to understand not just what you want to achieve, but what the other side wants to achieve. And where's the middle path? Russia generally would want to have a working relationship to protect its security, to make sure its confidence is there. And you know, instead of necessarily having people who are American allies literally a few hundred miles away from your capital, that's something they're not used to. So really understand their nervousness, now try and work out how to deal with it. But we've left it too late.
The new plans will mean less oil revenues for Russia, and a faster transition to cleaner energy. But what it also means is a higher risk of inflation and recession across the continent. Said Pourreza, London.
Russia has asked the United States to explain to the world why it supported a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens such as plague and anthrax.
We assume that the U.S. Defense Department and the Presidential Administration of the United States are obliged to officially explain to the global community, officially, not through talking heads, about the programs in Ukraine.
The Foreign Ministry spokeswoman said Moscow has evidence indicating an emergency cleanup of the biological program pursued for military purposes. Sakharova added documents show the Ukrainian Health Ministry had ordered the destruction of samples of some pathogens after February the 24th. She also accused Washington of financing the program. The Ukrainian government has denied any such program in the country, while the U.S. Defense Department described the Russian accusation as absurd. That's while earlier on Tuesday, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland, admitted that Ukraine has biological research facilities. A United Nations war crimes panel has called on the United States to carry out thorough probes into civilian casualties caused by the country's airstrikes in Syria. The panel has urged Washington to ensure those responsible for violations of international humanitarian laws are held accountable. It has also asked the U.S. to make its findings public. The UN call comes as the U.S. military is accused of hiding information on its airstrikes against Syria in 2019. The New York Times had reported that the strikes, considered war crimes, claimed the lives of up to 64 Syrian women and children. Despite repeated calls, Washington has not conducted an independent probe into the 2019 bombings so far. This is while the U.S. is also under fierce condemnation for its military presence in the Arab country without the permission of Damascus. Washington justifies its troop deployment there under the pretext of fighting Daesh. Elsewhere, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country will launch a number of reconnaissance satellites in the coming years as tensions continue to rise on the Korean Peninsula. North Korean leader says the new satellites will provide real-time information on military actions by the United States and its allies. Kim says a lot of military reconnaissance satellites will be put into orbit in the period of a five-year plan first announced last year. Pyongyang, which has increased its missile launches recently, says it has conducted two satellite system tests so far this year. Washington and its regional allies say the tests involved ballistic missile launches. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command says it has heightened its ballistic missile defense readiness after, quote, a significant increase in North Korean missile testing. Final results from South Korea's presidential election show opposition candidate Yoon Suk-yeol has won the vote in one of the closest fought races in recent history in South Korea. According to the National Election Commission, Yoon edged out the ruling Democratic Party's Lee Jae-myung with 48.6% of the vote to 47.8%. Lee has already conceded defeat. Yoon replaces President Moon Jae-in, whose single five-year term ends in May. Following his victory, Yoon said he would rebuild alliance with the United States and will develop relations with China based on mutual respect. The president-elect said he would respond to North Korea's, quote, nuclear threat, but would leave the door open to dialogue. He also promised to build a strong defense to deter any provocation. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The speed of Western retaliation over Russia's invasion of Ukraine has raised eyebrows among Yemenis who have endured a relentless bombing campaign and deadly air, land, and sea blockade for 2,520 consecutive days, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article titled Tears for Ukraine, Sanctions for Russia, Yawns for Yemen, Arms for Saudis, The West, Grotesque Double Standard. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. We are brutally bombed every day, so why doesn't the Western world care like it does about Ukraine? Is it because we don't have blonde hair and blue eyes like Ukrainians? Ahmad Tamri, a Yemeni father of four, asked with furrowed brows about the outpouring of international support and media coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the lack of such a reaction to the war in Yemen. Over the weekend, a member of Tamri's family was killed and nine relatives injured when their family home was targeted in a Saudi-led coalition airstrike in the remote Al-Sakhf area in Hajeh Governorate. Tamri claims that Al-Sakhf has been subjected to a brutal Saudi bombing campaign for the past 7 years, more so, he says, than all of Ukraine has endured since it was invaded by Russia. Despite the horrific bombing campaign against Yemeni civilians, Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and war crimes have garnered nowhere near the level of coverage and sympathy that the mainstream Western media has rightfully given to Ukraine. They shed tears for the Ukrainians and ignore our tragedies. What hypocrisy and racism, Tamri told Min Press News. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine continues, an outpouring of support for Ukrainians continues to be seen across the Western world. Severe sanctions against Russia have been imposed by the United States, Europe, Australia, and the West in general, amid a flurry of emergency talks at the UN Security Council. The speed of Western retaliation, which includes banning Russia from the SWIFT, that is, Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, International Banking Network, and calls to treat Russians as international pariah in sports, culture, and even science, has raised eyebrows among Yemenis who have endured a relentless bombing campaign and deadly air, land, and sea blockade for 2,550 consecutive days. When Russian forces began their wide-ranging assault on Ukraine, the Saudi-led coalition, supported by the U.S. regime, has launched more airstrikes in Yemen than Russia has in Ukraine. In Hajeh, a province surrounded by heavy Saudi artillery, Saudi-led coalition warplanes launched more than 150 airstrikes on the cities of Harath, Hiran, Up, and Mustab, killing scores of civilians, including a father of six killed over the weekend by a Saudi drone that targeted his car as it traveled between Shafar and Khamis al-Wahat market. Since Russia's incursion into Ukraine began, dozens of civilians, including a number of African migrants, have been killed and hundreds wounded by Saudi artillery and air strikes in Yemen's heavily populated Sa'dah province, declared a military area by Saudi Arabia at the start of its military campaign in March 2015. As news cameras and solidarity protests gave much-needed sympathy to Ukrainian civilians in Sana'a, Yemen, which has effectively been turned into a large prison for the city's more than 4 million residents and refugees, thanks to a crippling Saudi blockade, warplanes bombed a number of densely populated areas, including the airport. An additional 160 air strikes were launched on the provinces of Ma'rib, Al-Jaf, Al-Bayda, Taiz, Najran, and Hodeidah, the main entry point for commercial goods and aid into a country facing the worst man-made famine in the 21st century. In fact, it seems as though the Saudi regime is taking advantage of a distracted media in order to escalate attacks on a number of sensitive targets along the Yemen-Saudi border and strengthen its hold over the Al-Mahra governorate. The UAE, the other major Western-backed oil monarchy occupying Yemen, is likewise making hay, accelerating its project to change the demographics on the prized Socotra Island by displacing locals in favor of settlers more aligned with UAE policies. As countries that have spent the past decades building literal and figurative walls to keep out desperate brown and black refugees fleeing violence and foreign invasion in their own lands open their arms, homes, and hearts to fleeing Ukrainian refugees, Saudi Arabia unleashed the force of Yemeni mercenaries upon their homeland with a promise of a Saudi green card and safety for their families if they turn on their fellow countrymen. Ironically named the Happy Yemen Forces, the unit was finalized in late 2021 according to leaked military documents, with a mandate to secure Saudi Arabia's border with Yemen and ensure Saudi security in exchange for a green card and access to the Saudi social services that come with it. In terms of their sheer cost of human life, the tragedy in Yemen has been much more deadly than that in Ukraine, where 325 Ukrainians, including 14 children, have tragically lost their lives, according to Ukrainian officials. Granted, the war in Yemen has raged on unabated for more than 6 years, but comparatively, the numbers are astonishing. Since 2015, the death toll has reached an estimated 400,000 people, including 3,900 children. Those deaths have included attacks on civilians so egregious that they did garner fleeing media attention, but inevitably no sanctions, little international condemnation, not even a cessation in the military aid and support to the perpetrators. Bombed out schools, funerals, wedding halls, refugee camps, even a school bus full of children targeted by the most advanced U.S. weaponry on offer have not been sufficient to elicit the reaction that Ukraine has garnered in less than 1 week. Since 2015, Saudi-led coalition warplanes have pounded Yemen with over 266,000 air strikes, according to the Yemeni Army Operations Room. which records airstrikes against civilian and military targets. 70% of those strikes have hit civilian targets. The rising smoke, rubble and flames now seen in Ukraine have been the status quo in Yemen for years, with Western media often deeming the images that appear on local Yemeni television stations of parents pulling pieces of their children out from the rubble of their homes or schools too graphic to display.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
By the BBC. Smears, lies, and Islamophobia. Just a few of the criticisms hurled at the BBC following the release of a controversial documentary. Released in 2019, the 54-minute programme seeks to expose what it claims are Shia clerics acting as pimps and sexual exploitation of vulnerable Iraqi widows under the gaze of Shia Islam's religious authorities. However, after the film's release, Iraqis responded negatively, furiously condemning the documentary and even petitioning for its removal.
You can't attack the doctrine because the abuse of ignorant people or those who are corrupt.
Those who look at this documentary will have the fuel and will have the somehow justification for themselves to incite others to attack Shias.
There are authorized people you can ask, but you come to dirty humans and ask them instead.
So I decided to travel to Iraq, meet those who spoke with the BBC, and investigate why so many Iraqis felt betrayed rather than saved by the BBC. The majority of the filming for Iraq's secret sex trade took place here in Qardamiya. Located in Iraq's capital city, Baghdad, Qardamiya is considered one of Shia Islam's holiest sites. The main mosque, which contains the resting place of two of Shia Islam's holy imams, is featured throughout the program.
Now, these holy sites for Shia Muslims are supervised by the Ataba religious authorities. However, the program suggested that the Ataba and these holy sites were somehow linked or maybe even responsible for the criminal acts that they recorded on film.
The BBC's investigation begins with an attempt at explaining muta, a form of temporary marriage permitted during the time of the Prophet Muhammad. Using undercover filming, the BBC then exposes what it claims were clerics acting as pimps and using muta to run a sex racket. But scholars I spoke to on the subject explained it very differently.
What can you tell me about muta marriage?
Temporary marriage was known at the time of the Prophet ﷺ, practiced by the Sahaba. So it was something for certain circumstances. And in brief, when a student goes, for example, for study abroad for 3-4 years, and needs some sort of, the natural urges to be fulfilled, he cannot go for permanent marriage. So they try to do this.
There's no difference between permanent and temporary marriage except for the time and dowry. Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful, gave all the decision-making for marriage into the lady's authority. And if her guardian tries to ban her from marrying someone who's good and honest, they don't have the right to do this, especially if she's older and wise enough to take care of herself. The contract is never complete without her permission.
But this wasn't the only issue which offended so many. What really bothered the many critics was the BBC linking Iraq's highest religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani, to sexual exploitation. Beloved by millions of Muslims worldwide and accredited with saving Iraq from terrorism, for Iraqis, seeing Sayyid Sistani questioned alongside low-ranking criminals went down badly with viewers.
It's very offensive. It's completely unacceptable. And that is why we wrote to the BBC and we highlighted that such association is completely unjustifiable and can never be accepted at all. Here is a man who has worked tirelessly to ensure that the rights of women are indeed looked after. And he himself has issued a number of instructions and decrees for the protection and preservation of the of women. And he condemned such practices as well. You know, when he was asked by the BBC itself, he issued a statement which said this is unacceptable.
During my travels, I headed down to the holy city of Karbala in southern Iraq. Karbala is one of the holiest places for Shia Muslims, with millions visiting its grand mosques every year to pay their respects to the Prophet's grandson Imam Hussein, who was martyred at this location 1,300 years ago.
What an amazing place. Just take a look at the background. Whether you're Sunni or Shia, you're going to love the architecture and the beauty of this grand mosque. Regardless of which sect you belong to, this place is beautiful.
The BBC came here too and spoke with Sheikh Ahmad Al-Asadi to see if the Ataba organisation, which administers the holy sites, condoned the practice.
They came to us to ask about our locations for marriage services and our procedures and services. During the conversation, we discussed muta marriage. But when you look at the finished BBC programme, it focuses on illegal sexual businesses. From what they showed when they came to Ataba, they wanted to send a message to the world that Islam insults women, an issue which the West has actually, treating women as objects of lust for money. For us, marriage is a holy process. The BBC has no right to bring what the West believes about women and apply it to us.
Despite providing the BBC with detailed answers to their questions, Sheikh Al-Asadi's talk was edited down to an astonishing 28 seconds in the entire one-hour program.
The ones who interviewed us were not honest. They didn't transfer anything we discussed. The interview lasted 35 minutes, but they were not professional and they didn't use most of what we discussed. They transferred just what they wanted and left the rest behind. The BBC treated us without justice or in a professional way. They treated us like an intelligence agency would treat an interrogation suspect. The Ataba was targeted in this program after Grand Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa to fight Daesh. They wanted to knock down the Ataba and show a black image about us.
The BBC clearly wasn't making any friends, but was the documentary trying to mislead people about Iraq?
After speaking to the same individual that the BBC spoke to here inside the Ataba, it is very clear that there is a degree of resentment towards the BBC for the type of filming that they did here. Obviously, this was an important subject which needed to be highlighted, but the problem is the BBC appears to have launched a character assassination campaign against the most senior figures here in Iraq, including the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani.
Following our talk, I decided to look into what these scholars are up to myself. In particular, the work spearheaded by the organisations associated with the holy mosques.
So just one of the many things which the organisation has set up to help deal with the people's needs is hospitals, in particular since the outbreak of the coronavirus. This, of course, has been vitally needed as the government in Iraq hasn't been able to fulfil the needs of the people, especially during a global pandemic which nobody anticipated would arrive.
I visited schools, hospitals, orphanages, universities and charities, including ones that assist women who had lost loved ones during the horrific war against Daesh. None of this was shown by the BBC.
We have two projects with UN support. The first is related to helping Iraqi women, including the young who receive abuse in society. The second helps to protect refugees from the wars who may have been abused too.
With so many discrepancies already being discovered, I wanted to find out what else the BBC had conveniently forgotten to mention. Back in London, I got in touch with Iraqi activists who had been rigorously researching the BBC's claims and findings. Due to fear of repercussions for their work, we have chosen to protect their identity. What they found was stunning.
We found more than 73 mistranslations within the documentary. One single documentary by one of the largest media corporations in the world. 73 mistranslations. None of the individuals who are accused of misconduct in the documentary are linked in any way to the shrines. None of those individuals have committed any of those crimes inside the shrines or indeed with any cooperation with anyone from those shrines. The shrines and these criminals do not have any links, and yet the BBC were very clearly pushing this narrative to the audience that the shrines had something to do with this misconduct and this abuse and these crimes they were trying to report on. Again, shifting the focus away from the real criminals. What they have demonstrated is cowardice, or there seems to be a narrative they were following instead of the truth.
Many senior Muslim groups complained to the BBC following the documentary's release. However, the BBC's replies have been more than a little disappointing.
As a result of the investigation and the information we have gathered and the detailed analysis of the documentary, we started sharing our findings in a formal way to the BBC. We logged a complaint to the BBC and said to them very clearly, laid down the details of the findings, including the mistranslation, including the factual errors they had, including the lack of balance and objectivity when they were representing information, including the way they failed the real victims by ignoring some really difficult areas. Areas of violence and abuse. But throughout the process, they were making corrections, to be fair to them. They were making corrections, of course, after millions had watched the erroneous, mistake-filled version. But even after they were making these corrections, neither did they admit, nor did they announce, that they were making the correction. So they did it in a very subtle and sneaky way.
They denied responsibility, they denied liability, and they completely let their credibility and their professional responsibility down.
After the program went live, anger in the community spread rapidly,
action was taken, including a petition to cancel the documentary and coordinated press releases.
And this indeed
Sheikh Mohammed Al-Hilli was one of the many prominent Muslim speakers who condemned the film as Islamophobic.
When you watch this particular documentary, is the an idea that somehow Shia Muslims are supportive of such practices, or at least they're silent about it. Of course, the other problem I had personally with the documentary is the lack of representation and the opportunity for scholars who are able to speak English, or at least from the Shia community, to present their opinion regarding what was going on.
Despite the information being provided to the BBC of their inaccuracies, no action was taken to correct the issues, despite the BBC's promises to do so. Another prominent voice of damnation came from Ayatollah Milani, known and respected in both Iraq and the UK. He informed me that the BBC had an obsession with Muta going back years.
This is unfortunately not the first time that BBC does that. 5 years ago, they interviewed me about the temporary marriage. And in details, I explained the history of that and all the principles of that in a very clear way. I provided the presenter with a copy of my book, Islamic Family Law, where a chapter in that is discussing in details the whole idea and concept of temporary marriage. But unfortunately, when they produced it and it was broadcasted, I found that a lady was interviewed, and she said after my work and my interview that temporary marriage is like prostitute. And when they asked me, I mean the producer of this BBC video, when they asked me about my opinion and to interview me, I said, look, I have a very bad experience from the previous time.
All this was enough to upset Iraqis, but I noticed other issues yet unhighlighted.
The fact that the BBC continuously mentioned irrelevant points, such as the criminals claiming to be descended from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, combined with the journalist using her own personal views, such as claims that Sharia law grants fewer rights to women, adds that with the use of subliminal messaging, such as the constant use of mosques and holy sites throughout the entire program, all appears to be aimed at convincing the audience that Islam is an oppressive religion. Now, that's very interesting, given the fact that the programme also failed to mention, even once throughout the entire hour-long documentary, the 2003 British-supported invasion and occupation of Iraq. Now, that is very interesting, given that the invasion totally destroyed the country, impoverished millions, and left so many vulnerable to criminal elements in society, particularly Iraqi women.
But would the BBC do all this knowingly? I spoke to one former BBC staff member to find out.
Can the BBC honestly claim that they are impartial?
One of the things that the BBC says when it's espousing its vision around the world, usually through the arm of BBC World Service, it's the idea that we are objective, we are impartial, and we are unbiased. These things cannot be true when you're dealing with the news. Sometimes there's a guilty party, sometimes there's an innocent party. Through omission, through a choice of whether or not to include a particular voice, to downplay a particular voice, or even the omission of a particular story, you're making it quite clear what side of the argument you're on. Now, when I worked for the corporation, like most of the journalists who were employed, I was there on a freelance basis. I was there as a presenter, as a producer in the London section. And you saw policy-making decisions. When I oversaw decisions being made, they were clearly done through a chain of command. So you couldn't just come up with a story and independently go and deal with it. You would have to go through an editor, through a producer, perhaps even through a line manager, Lawyers would check over your content from time to time. I mean, we'd even have the pronunciation department call you up and say, that's not quite how you say that name. Now, all of these things are being done for checks and balances, but they're also being done with one eye on, is this the kind of stuff we want to run? Is this the kind of stuff that will make us look bad? Does this represent core BBC value stuff?
Back in Cardamier, I decided that the only thing missing from my investigation was the criminals themselves. So before leaving Iraq, I decided to try and find those involved in abusing the Mutta practice.
Now, the way it was described at the time by the journalist reporting in the documentary was like she was almost entering into a red light district. It was a shady area which did questionable marriage services. But actually, on the contrary, there is a very family atmosphere here. This place is, you know, where people bring their children to come and visit one of Shia Islam's holiest sites. There are markets here, many shops, and Iraqi society is very conservative, so for anyone to be conducting practices which could be compared to prostitution openly in a place like this would certainly not be tolerated by the local community or by the authorities which patrol this area on a day-to-day 24-hour basis.
Speaking to locals, it became immediately clear that those exposed by the BBC had a poor reputation to begin with.
They just brought someone from the street. He is not educated in the religion. When you want to talk about anything, you need to bring a specialist.
It wasn't long before we found the brother of Raad, Rawad Al-Kabur. Raad was one of the men exposed by the BBC in their documentary. Rawad agreed to speak to us about the BBC and his brother's conduct.
My brother has no office or license. He's not authorized to do any marriage contract. These people, they just lied to say something bad about Raad and Islam. If I see anyone doing unlicensed mutter marriage, I would insult them and their great-grandfathers.
After attempting to defend his brother, we asked if he would bring us to Raad for further scrutiny. Raad, however, refused to show himself. We also failed to track down Sheikh Salawi, who was also filmed by the BBC. However, we were told by researchers that he was not a recognised scholar and didn't represent any mosque, Atiba or Sistani's office.
Our investigation took multiple dimensions. One of the dimensions was to go on the ground and identify those individuals. Who they are? Who do they represent? What qualifications do they have? Do they really exist? And that investigation very quickly uncovered that someone called Sayyid Raad was not a Sayyid. He has absolutely no qualification, no religious background, yet he was represented by the BBC as a cleric. We told them that, by the way, you haven't done your due diligence by looking after who these people are. But they denied that and said, no, we have done our due diligence. We asked to see evidence of that, but they failed to answer.
Documentary, in as far as presenting this, is not necessarily, we are not necessarily in any shape or form objecting to the presentation of this abuse. But we have to remember this, that in many war-torn countries, such abuse takes place. This is no justification. But it doesn't matter whether you're Shia, you're Sunni, you're Hindu, you're Jew, you're Christian. This kind of practice happens all around the world, and it's wrong, it's completely unacceptable. But to somehow continuously frame it to be a Shia thing, which the name of the documentary, which the documentary itself continuously sought to do, was something that, of course, we are completely unhappy with. And we voiced our concerns through legitimate means, through a very well presented and researched document which involved research in Iraq to go and speak to offices where somehow these rogue elements were working and issuing marriage certificates to young children and so on, where we've investigated how these people who are doing it have no no relation whatsoever with the seminary, have no relation whatsoever with the clerical establishment, have no relation whatsoever with Ayatollah Sistani. They just happen to be criminals.
Now, of course, no one would have a problem with the BBC over its coverage of women being mistreated in Iraqi society. Obviously, it is a problem, and regardless of who covers it, it is, of course, something which is greatly important. However, the problem with the programme is that it seems to have purposefully missed out key aspects of the story here in Iraq. The way in which the film was styled seems to suggest that the Iraqi religious leadership has purposefully neglected Iraqi women, especially those most in need, and has also failed to police the practice of muta, or temporary marriage, both of which is actually not the case, as we've seen in our time here in Iraq.
The Limelight.
The US military is supposedly there to protect people. It does the opposite, said John Reich, a Seattle-based writer specializing in American bases in Okinawa. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Alarming Levels of Forever Chemicals Found in Water Near U.S. Bases in Okinawa. Stay tuned for more.